Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today to talk about the Israeli ceasefire with Lebanon. It's been 18 hours, and if you're Jewish, you know the number 18 is very significant, as it actually symbolizes life itself. Before I get into the conversation, if you appreciate and find value in these discussions, please consider supporting the show, so I can continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests and conversations. Details are pinned in the comments below. Though I have my personal opinions about making a deal with the devil, especially when the devil is on the verge of total collapse, I'm going to go on the safe assumption that Netanyahu knows more than I do about what is good for Israel, and I'm going to focus today on what I see as the positive strategic implications of this deal. Before I get into it, I do want to get into sort of a brief overview of the war with Hezbollah. So much focus on the international stage has been on the war with Hamas, and I think that there are some people who don't even realize that Hamas and Hezbollah are different terrorist organizations, both, of course, factions of the Iranian terrorist regime. However, one is in the south, which would be Hamas in Gaza, and one is in the north, which would be Lebanon and Hezbollah. Keep in mind that Hamas actually is the governing force in Gaza. But in Lebanon, Hezbollah, though it does have a place in the Lebanese government, it is not actually the Lebanese government. Technically, Lebanon is a legitimate state, and Hezbollah is a terrorist element that happens to reside and operate from within it. So let's just start with that framework. How did this conflict with Hezbollah begin? So keep in mind that I think everybody knows what happened on October 7th. I hope you know what happened on October 7th, which was this horrific massacre, pogrom, genocide from Hamas terrorists coming into Israel from the south. And we hopefully all know what happened from there. I'm not going to really get into that today. What some people don't know is that just one day later, on October 8th, Hezbollah in the north decided that they wanted in on the action. Okay, so I want to keep in mind that Lebanon and Israel have no territorial disputes. Okay, so this was not even about like getting a state, which honestly, that's not what Hamas is about either. Hamas exists to destroy the Jewish state. It's right in their charter. It's not about getting their own state. It's about getting rid of the Jewish state. Nonetheless, there is no territorial dispute between Hezbollah and Israel, okay? The only reason that Hezbollah exists, exactly the same way that Hamas exists, is to destroy the state of Israel. Keep that in mind. When Hezbollah decided to join this war on October 8th, the day after the Hamas massacre, they came in and started shooting missiles at Israel, keeping in mind that the original plan was actually for them to do another October 7th style massacre simultaneously from the north. Why that didn't happen, nobody really knows, but thank God it didn't. Nonetheless, on October 8th, and every single day since, Hezbollah has been firing rockets at Israel, okay? So understand that by the time Israel really, really started to retaliate, which is about 2 months ago, I know it seems like forever ago, Hezbollah had fired 9,000 missiles into Israel. Okay. Now, I know that sometimes when we're not in Israel, these numbers are like, oh, okay, so what? Imagine 9,000 missiles raining in on your country, and then imagine that your country is the size of the state of New Jersey. Okay. That's a lot of missiles. And this is very typical that Israel doesn't really go in full force on anything until they hit this tipping point. Okay. 9,000 mile missile, sorry, tipping point reached. Another thing to keep in mind is that because Hamas shares only two borders, okay, right? So they have the maritime, which is the sea, which is basically blockaded by the Israel military to ensure that munitions do not get in from enemy forces. Then on Gaza, on the top and on the western border, you have Israel. Again, the IDF securing those borders to ensure that munitions don't get in. And then at the bottom, you might have heard of the Philadelphia Corridor. That is the border that Gaza shares with Egypt, which, yes, Egypt also, theoretically, patrols to avoid munitions getting into Gaza. What that means is that Gaza has really very primitive weaponry. Okay, they literally make missiles out of the water pipes that are sent to them to create infrastructure for the people of Gaza. Now, not the same with Hezbollah. Hezbollah does share a bit of a their southern border, of course, with Israel. But they also have total freedom of movement because they're an independent state and of importing munitions, particularly from Iran and its proxies, on all its other borders. So though Lebanon is the tiniest country, yes, it's significantly smaller than even Israel, they literally have had one of the largest munition supplies of any nation on earth. Okay? Why? Because the Iranian regime, okay, under the Ayatollah, created what they would call a ring of fire around Israel by arming anti-Israel proxies, basically surrounding Israel and in many hundreds of miles in each direction. Of course, Israel does have peace treaties with Egypt and with Jordan. So basically Egypt would be in the south and Jordan would be in the west. I'm not even going to get into the diplomatic implications of those. Let's just say they're not in the Iranian Ring of Fire, but everyone else pretty much is. And of this Ring of Fire, Hezbollah was by far the kingpin of the whole mob. Okay, so Iran basically used Hezbollah as like their insurance policy that Israel could be destroyed if they decided they want to destroy Israel. Because in contrast to the very primitive weaponry that Hamas uses, we're talking about like the most sophisticated missile technology in Hezbollah, in Lebanon, but also that they had somewhere in the vicinity of 150,000 to 180,000 missiles. Now, the real deterrence there was that the reason why it has taken Israel so many years, almost 20 years, to really go in and finally dismantle this is because, theoretically, Hezbollah had the capacity to actually fire thousands of missiles at a time at Israel that even the Iron Dome would not have been able to protect. And the common thought was that if Israel gets into a war with Lebanon, the effects to Israel and to Lebanon, honestly, because Israel does not put up with a lot of crap, would have been devastating. Okay, we saw in the last 2 months that didn't happen, not because Hezbollah didn't want it to happen, but because Israel preempted Hezbollah in two ways. One was to take out basically their entire hierarchy. I'll get into that again later, but also that they were able to preempt certain strikes and destroy not just the munitions themselves, but even the launching capabilities, okay? This was huge. And so Has Hezbollah caused havoc in Israel? Yes. Major havoc. They have destroyed, I don't know the number, massive amounts of acreage in the north of Israel. And yes, we lost a bunch of soldiers and some civilians in the war, but nothing close to what people were expecting if this war were to occur. Now, what happened was that because Hezbollah has effectively forced 60,000 Israeli citizens to be displaced from the north, it's almost as if Israel has had to give up that territory, right? Because what's the point of having territory if you can't be in that territory? Now, obviously, this was an untenable reality in the long run, and that Israel was going to have to, at some point, go to war with Hezbollah. And they waited until that point where they knew that they could master the element of surprise. You guys probably all remember about the beepers and then the walkie-talkies. And let's just go back to the fact that not only was the head of Hezbollah, Nasrallah, taken out, okay, assassinated, but so were his two immediate successors, one within, I don't know, minutes or hours, and then the other one, and also about 10,000 of the next most likely successors, okay? So in all, right now, Hezbollah is a terrorist organization that, like all ideologies, continues to exist, and I don't think anybody, including Israel, believes that it can ultimately be completely dismantled. However, there is no one in charge. There's no central command. There's no central communications. There's no coordination. Now it's just like this weird rogue force that is basically people going against Israel because they hate Israel rather than because they have, you know, some grand poobah who's telling them what to do, okay? So on top of the entire hierarchy being assassinated, on top of what is estimated to be 80 to 90% of all their munitions being destroyed and their launchers, keep in mind that Hezbollah had an even more intricate tunnel network than what we've seen in Gaza with Hamas. And because there are no hostages hiding in it, Israel was able to go in and dismantle and destroy most of their tunnel infrastructure as well. Okay. Now, for those of you who don't know, Israel, there was a UN security resolution, when was I think 2006? Sorry, this I should know, that was supposed to force Lebanon back to what's called the Litani River, which was supposed to provide sort of like a southern buffer zone, southern Lebanon, northern Israel, between Hezbollah forces and Israel. And as of, I think yesterday, the day that the ceasefire was declared, but possibly the day before, the IDF got to and cleared to the Litani River. This was like a huge win for the IDF. And among the ceasefire deal is the fact that even though UNIFIL, useless UN agency, was not able to do their job to keep peace between Lebanon and Israel and was not able to keep Hezbollah behind the Litani River as mandated by the United Nations itself, nonetheless, Israel was able to recreate some semblance of safety in that, we'll call it, a buffer zone between the border and the Litani River. Now, what's most significant to me personally, and I haven't really heard anybody else talking about this per se, is the 60-day time frame of this ceasefire deal. Now, if 60 days seems like sort of like an arbitrary time frame to you, I suggest you take a moment and do the math. What's happening in 60 days? Oh, right. The Trump inauguration. When Trump comes back into power in America, there will be a new sheriff in town. And that town would be the Middle East. And believe me, the Middle East is already taking note, okay? This ceasefire agreement is only occurring because of fear of what Trump would do if it did not occur, because he has given his word that these ceasefires must happen. And even Iran is saying, hey, let's talk. You know, what are a few, whatever, missiles between friends and terror tunnels and hostages? And so we're seeing like a realignment of the Middle East in anticipation of Trump coming back into power in 60 days, again, not ironically, the same duration of this ceasefire deal. Okay, so here's what happens. Like, so why now? Why now? Why did Amos Hochstein decide that he needed now to give Israel and Lebanon, Hezbollah, depending on who you look at as the actual negotiator, an ultimatum that if they don't come to a ceasefire agreement, America is going to basically back out and not take part. Now, you have to understand that this war is not just about the military, okay? This is a war that is on many levels, political and diplomatic. And by agreeing to the ceasefire, one thing that it does is it appeases Biden by giving him a very important diplomatic win, okay? Now, I do want to say that though I do not believe the Biden-Harris administration has stood by Israel the way that it should with its staunchest ally in this past year, we do have to keep in mind that Biden is actually a Zionist. I mean, he calls himself a Zionist. He doesn't win any political points by saying that. He doesn't win political points by showing up in Israel and saying that. So I do believe that at his heart, Biden does want the best for Israel. But at the same time, he also needs to protect what he sees as his legacy, and I see as perhaps his ego, by also is pandering too mean a word to the radical left that is very, very anti-Israel, right? So he's been speaking out of both sides of his mouth. And on one hand, he's like, here, Israel, have some, you know, whatever, missiles, bombs, like, equipment. And on the other hand, he's like, bad Israel, you are bad people, and something's gonna have to change, okay? So if history teaches us anything, and I think it does because it tends to repeat itself, and it doesn't just tend to repeat itself, it tends to repeat itself over and over and over again. Let's go back to the second Obama administration. Now, I don't know if you're aware of what happened in the UN Security Council right before Obama left office. I mean, it was in December, so it was not like the second before, but about a month before. Was that Obama chose to abstain rather than what America would traditionally do, which is veto UN Security Council Resolution 2334, which basically denied that Israel had any claim to any of the ancestral homeland. Not any of it, but to like places like, say, Jerusalem and the Western Wall, Judea and Samaria, places that have been Jewish historically since biblical times. And he allowed that to pass, which really undermined the legitimacy of Israel and really, really hurt Israel in the United Nations. So we'll talk about the United Nations later, but for right now, I just want to say the second thing that Obama did. And when I say right before he left office, I mean literally, like, he's leaving the office. He's got, like, one foot out the door. This is, like, the last hour or two of his presidency. He very quietly decided that he was going to send $230 million to the Palestinian Authority. Interesting, huh? So we know where his priorities were, and I think we all know that right now we're in the middle of the Biden administration, that Biden may be the guy on top, and I say maybe because Obama may be the guy on top, but either way, we know that Obama is playing a big hand in all U.S. policy right now. And so, by giving Biden this diplomatic win that he so desperately wanted, perhaps what Netanyahu was able to do was to preempt the Biden administration from repeating what happened with the Obama administration vis-a-vis the UN. Because if I were a betting man, I would bet that the UN is going to test this theory and put as many resolutions as they can against Israel before Trump comes into office to give Biden the opportunity to allow them to pass something that might be very, very, very drastic and painful for Israel. So that remains to be seen, but on a diplomatic front, it was pretty important that Netanyahu, after getting this ultimatum from Hochstein, take note and do something to support the Biden administration, because ultimately Israel does need America. And in case you don't know, America actually needs Israel too. That's a talk for another day. So we have a ceasefire. It's been now 19 hours, just about 19 hours. I haven't been online in the last, 20 minutes. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't have a ceasefire anymore, but I'm going to go on the assumption that we do. Let's talk about the history of ceasefires between Israel and terrorist organizations. For example, Hamas and Hezbollah. One thing that you need to know is that Israel has never broken a ceasefire. But you know who has? Hamas and Hezbollah. Every single time. Now, sometimes they behave better than others, and the ceasefire can last for years. Sometimes not so much. Sometimes they literally last for hours. And we even saw, like, 1 year ago with the big hostage deal, where every few days Israel was going to get a few hostages back for, like, hundreds of Palestinian prisoners plus a ceasefire, that Hamas couldn't even make it to the end of that agreement, right? They had to break that ceasefire and start shooting. So I wouldn't give Hezbollah too much credit that these bad actors are suddenly going to be good actors, other than the fact that maybe they understand that if they do not comply, their very existence is at stake. So maybe they have an existential bone in their body. Keep in mind, it's a very broken body that would preclude them from breaking this ceasefire. But for right now, we have a ceasefire, and if Hezbollah breaks it, okay, if Hezbollah decides in the next, day, 2 days, 25 days, this is, again, a 60-day ceasefire agreement, if they decide to break this agreement, there are mechanisms in place where Israel can justifiably go in and attack again. So this is interesting because the world, has on so many levels like claimed that this is an illegitimate war that Israel has no right to fight. Israel that's literally fighting for their very existence against Iran and its terrorist proxies on 7 different fronts, 8 if you count the diplomatic front and the war of words. If Hezbollah does what historically they always have done, break this agreement, then Israel gets to go in and attack, okay? That is significant because it means that Israel actually has the mechanism in place to stop Hezbollah from rearming, from rebuilding, from reorganizing, from retunneling. And another thing that's interesting is that originally, remember, or maybe you remember, maybe you don't, maybe you know, maybe you never knew, the Hezbollah said that they had joined this war to support Hamas. Now, just know that Hezbollah and Hamas aren't exactly friends. They just happen to share a common enemy, Israel, Jews. Okay, so originally Hezbollah said, okay, well, we will agree to a ceasefire when you agree to a ceasefire with Hamas. Okay, so where's Hamas in all this? Answer, nowhere. So this ceasefire decouples Hezbollah from Hamas. And this is, again, this is significant because now we're seeing the beginning of the fracturing of this ring of fire of all these Iranian proxy alliances that now are not only being broken up, but perhaps might even wind up being pitted against each other. Likewise, having this agreement, which was actually sanctioned, oddly enough, by Iran, may put pressure on Hamas to finally come to an agreement, okay? And remember that this war in Gaza, the one in Gaza, could have been ended on day one. On day one, if Hamas returned the hostages, they still have 101 hostages. Think about that. Think about your grandfather living under torture for over 400 days in a terror tunnel. Or your niece, your nephew. Aryon Kfir Bibas, still in Hamas captivity, okay, ages 1 and 5. Imagine 101 hostages. If Hamas had given back the hostages and just surrendered, this war would have ended instantly. But Israel has got to fight. It has to fight for its own security. And yes, it needs to get these hostages back. So that being said, Hamas has not been willing to do what it needs to do to get peace for itself and for the people of Gaza. I'm not even going to mention the people of Israel because, as previously mentioned, they just want to see them dead. But perhaps by Hezbollah coming to a ceasefire agreement, Hamas might wind up coming to the table. And it sort of looks like they're going to. So that is a really, really important, like, sort of trickle down effect of all this. Now, there's a lot of people, and I'm not going to pretend that I'm not among them, that thinks that this is a mistake. Making a deal with the devil never really ends well. And that ultimately, this is just going to give Hezbollah the chance to regroup, to create a new hierarchy, to rearm. That's all true. But one thing that we do need to keep in mind is that having, first of all, fighting this two-front war is an extreme hardship and burden on Israel itself. Right? So having the ceasefire not only gives Hezbollah the ability to regroup and recalibrate, but it also gives Israel the same opportunity. You have to keep in mind the IDF and the reservists are exhausted, okay? First of all, over 800 of them have been killed so far in this war. This is devastating beyond belief for a country that is as tiny as Israel. Everybody in Israel knows somebody who was either killed in the war, taken hostage, severely injured, and it's also a whole entire nation that is suffering from PTSD. Okay, so there's that to keep in mind. But these IDF soldiers and reservists, some of them have been fighting for hundreds of days without respite. It is exhausting. It's physically exhausting. It's mentally exhausting. It's emotionally exhausting. It's spiritually exhausting. Not to mention the fact that it gets in the way of relationships. It's hard on their families. And not just on a personal level, but keep in mind that all of these soldiers who have been fighting for all this time are not working. They're not going to their jobs. They're not earning the income that they need to support their families. These repercussions are tremendous. And by having a ceasefire, it's going to give a whole lot of soldiers the opportunity to go home and to heal a little bit and to, you know, reestablish their personal lives and get back to some kind of normalcy. Everyone in the world needs normalcy. We need stability. We need equilibrium. We can't function at the level that Israel has been functioning at all this time. Now, beyond the political cost of the war, keep in mind that war itself is extremely expensive. Extremely expensive. We're talking billions and billions of dollars. And one of Iran's very tactics is to fight a war of attrition so that Israel has an endless war until like they just run out of money, munitions, and or international support. I mean, they've certainly made a lot of headway in the international support arena. Okay. So another thing to keep in mind, though, in the north, right, on the Lebanese border and surrounding it, we have approximately 60,000 Israelis who have been displaced from their homes. Now for well over a year, literally like living in hotels as refugees in their own country. They need to be able to go home. Now, I don't think that like today they're like, oh, everything's safe, let's go back. I don't think tomorrow or next week, but I think that by the time the new sheriff comes in 60 days, perhaps some of them, a certain percentage at least of the Israeli population, will be ready to go back into the north, rebuild and create or recreate the community there. Because again, the fact that so many people have been displaced means that that has been a de facto loss of territory. And Israel cannot afford, and it should not be giving up ceding any of its land to terrorists. Now, as Netanyahu said yesterday, his number one reason for accepting this deal is to focus on Iran. Okay? Iran is the real issue here. All of these terrorist proxies are all being funded by Iran. And the Israel-Iran war, I'm putting that nicely because most likely it will become World War III. But let's call it the Israel-Iran war for now. It sounds a lot gentler. Is going to be the big war. This is the big issue. Why? Because somebody has to take out the Iranian nuclear infrastructure. Not just so Iran won't destroy Israel, but in case you haven't gotten the memo, Iran wants more than anything to destroy the United States. They cannot be allowed to get nuclear bombs. Hard stop. And keep in mind that right now, due to the airstrikes that Israel conducted approximately a month ago, not even a month ago, a few weeks ago, basically the entire air defense system in Iran has been dismantled. Iran is actually completely vulnerable and basically defenseless right now. If Israel does decide to go in, they will just be able to like fly in and do what they need to do. But what they need to do is going to require bigger, better bombs from, you guessed it, the United States of America. Okay? Is this going to happen under Biden? Never say never, but let's just say it's unlikely. More likely than that is that Iran is going to take this window, this lame duck period, as an opportunity to rush to create a bomb. Because they're very, very close to completing their goal. And I mean, Israel has taken out some of their nuclear infrastructure and set them back to an extent that I don't think anybody fully knows. But we have these like dueling forces now. Iran is going to rush to get the bomb before Trump comes to power because they know that they will not get the bomb once Trump comes to power. And likewise, Israel is going to have to do what they can to preempt the same. Okay. So ultimately, this war between Israel and Hezbollah is more than anything a war between Israel and Iran. And if you don't believe me, keep in mind that one of the reasons this ceasefire occurred is because the Ayatollah gave it a green light. If the Ayatollah were not in control, why would Hezbollah need Iran to say okay in order to sign a deal? This can't be understated. Iran is on their heels, on their back foot. Like they know it. Everybody knows it. And so at long last, big bad Iran is now basically begging for mercy. They're getting it now on the Lebanese front. We'll see what happens up there, right? Again, this was their crown jewel. And now Hezbollah is all but destroyed, and it will be decades before they can rebuild. Let's pray that they don't rebuild. Let's pray that these new security forces that include UNIFIL, but also the United States and France, are going to be able to prevent Hezbollah from rebuilding. We don't know, but it is a big deal that Iran, who is relying so much on Hezbollah for their destruction of the Jewish state, can no longer rely on Hezbollah. Not only not no longer rely on them, but actually conceded that they can no longer and will no longer be relying on them. That's huge. Okay. So keep in mind that in the ceasefire, there is a clause that Israel can go right back into Lebanon if Hezbollah breaches the deal in any way. So that might mean rearming. It might mean rebuilding tunnels. It might be launchers and in other infrastructure. Okay. What gives me pause is the fact that Hezbollah rearmed to the point where they did to the 150 to 180,000 missiles right under the world's noses. And yes, including Israel. I've always asked why this was allowed to occur, and I don't have any answers. So I can't really expound on how that happened, but I do worry that it happened before. Can it happen again? I think that most people are saying, yes, it can absolutely happen again. Will it happen again? I think most people are saying most likely it will happen again. But must it happen again? I think the answer is no. And I think that for a couple reasons, okay? Now, it has nothing to do with UNIFIL, okay? Let's go on record that UNIFIL is as ineffectual as UNRWA. Ineffectual, again, being a nice way of saying complicit in the terror that has been meted out by Hamas and by Hezbollah. They have been in on it and even have been proven to be members of said organizations. So, side note, the United Nations is not the benevolent purveyor of morality and human rights that the world is deceived into believing it is, okay? The United Nations is basically controlled by terrorists and dictators right now. And when you have like women's right and human right councils that have amazing states like Iran and Syria sitting on the councils, you have to question their legitimacy. I mean, really, you have to question it. And so organizations like UNRWA and UNIFIL are not just pointless, they're part of the problem. They are definitely not part of the solution. So the hope is that the US, France, and UNIFIL are going to enforce this agreement, keep Hezbollah behind the Litani River, create this buffer zone in southern Lebanon. But here's the other interesting element. It's not just the United States. It's not just the United States and France. It's not just the United States, France, and the UN. It's also the Lebanese army military that is going to help to enforce, okay? Again, the Lebanese army is not Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a terrorist militia that resides within Lebanon and, yes, does hold power within the Lebanese government, but it is not the actual Lebanese government and it is not the actual Lebanese military. So what happens when we have the Lebanese army coming in to enforce a ceasefire between Hezbollah and Israel? And by the way, what's the other military forces helping to enforce this? It's the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. Okay. What does this mean? It means that now the Lebanese army and the IDF are de facto collaborators. I'm not going to go so far as to call them allies, but they're working for the same team. That should raise eyebrows. Could Lebanon be a part of the Abraham Accords someday? Why the heck not? Why the heck not? Whoever thought the Abraham Accords would exist in the first place? Anyone could be a part of it. And if the Lebanese government and military turn on Hezbollah and expel them from the country, there's absolutely no reason why Lebanon can't have an agreement with Israel the same as Egypt and Jordan. Imagine how that would change the calculus of peace in the Middle East. Keep in mind, Lebanon is a real country with a real government that happens to have a real terrorist element in it. But this is not like Hamas. Hamas is the actual government of Gaza. There's no one to kick them out. There's no one to replace them without their consent. But in Lebanon, Lebanon could actually expel Hezbollah if they wanted to. And I feel like this agreement, the ceasefire agreement, to some extent helps to delegitimize Hezbollah from within Lebanon. And that can have huge repercussions. And there's something to be said also for timing, right? Like, okay, I'm going to make the weirdest analogy. Have you ever gotten so into a TV show and you're like, oh, I can't wait for the next season, and you're waiting and you're waiting, and then they have the grand finale and it like ends on a cliffhanger and you're still so absorbed in this story and you love this story and you love the characters and you want it to go on, but it ends. There's something to be said for quitting while you're ahead. Quitting being a weird word here, but that when you, there's a tipping point, right? There's a tipping point, if I'm talking about TV, where a show is endearing, where a show goes from endearing to annoying. And I think we've all seen that in a lot of TV shows. There's a definite analogy here that when Israel goes into, we'll say Lebanon in this case, but really it applies completely to Gaza as well. There's a significant percentage of the population that is actually grateful to the IDF for doing what needs to be done to remove the terrorist element from their midst. Because when there is a terrorist organization that has any semblance over control over a people, those people are basically hostages to that terrorist organization 365 days a year. Okay? And so there's a point where the IDF are liberators. You remember when the Allied forces, the United States, liberated Europe, how grateful the people of Europe were, even despite the mass destruction that they had been relieved of the axis of evil of the, you know, Nazi regime and their allies. So right now it's like Israel is creating a ceasefire at the point where there are still a significant number of Lebanese who are appreciative to the IDF for trying to or doing so much to dismantle the terrorist Hezbollah infrastructure that has been imprisoning them for so long. And now Israel gets to step out while popular sentiment, at least a percentage of it, is still on their side. There's something to be said for that. Okay. This has been an entire discussion really on playing devil's advocate. It's not that I don't believe what I'm saying. It's just that ultimately I have some real problems with this deal and with making a deal when you're so close to destroying whatever, Hezbollah completely. It was just a matter of a turn of a screw, but instead we removed the screwdriver. So I do want to mention two challenges that I really can't end this discussion without at least mentioning. The first one, which worries me tremendously, is that the global anti-Semitic genie is out of the bottle. And the way I see it right now, it's only going to get worse and continue to explode. If Israel literally declares, okay, war over, all good, total peace, Palestinian state, like all the things today, I think it would have close to zero impact on the anti-Semitic rage that has taken over the world. I think it's a completely separate and opportunistic moment where the anti-Semites can use what's going on in the Middle East as an excuse for the hatred, the violence, and the vitriol that was always there. I don't see that going away anytime soon, and I do think this is something that really, really needs to be reckoned with by all world leaders. So that's the first thing. The second thing, Hamas cannot get terms that are anything close to as lenient as what Hezbollah just got. First of all, we need all 101 hostages home. not 2, not 5, not 12, and not 50. We need to get 101 hostages home. And Israel has made such tremendous progress in defeating and dismantling Hamas that I think it will be the biggest mistake Israel has ever made if they agree to any long-term ceasefire without getting every single hostage back. Sadly, yes, we know approximately half of them are deceased, but they need a proper burial, and the other half need to be brought home to heal. The day after plan cannot end with Hamas or UNRWA in control anymore. And though there's no international force that really wants to go in and police or govern Gaza, we're going to need an international force exactly the same way that US and France is doing in Lebanon. Otherwise, Israel is going to have no choice but to occupy Gaza to make sure that they don't radicalize again and don't pose the kind of threat that they posed and created with Israel on October 7th. The only way to avoid that from happening is for the world to step in and create a better future for Gaza. Gaza could be Tel Aviv, one of the most vibrant and incredible cities literally in the world. It could be Singapore. Countries will pour billions of dollars into rebuilding Gaza if they're willing to step away from terror and just step in and become like a part of the peaceful world. Ultimately, all Israel wants, all I want, is peace in the Middle East. That means peace and security for the citizens of Israel, for the Jewish people, for the entire Middle East, and honestly, for the world. Am Yisrael Chai.